Hello and welcome to Presenting, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games, typically Paizo products such as Pathfinder and Starfinder, but also others. I'm John Godek, and with me today is Luis Loza. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, it is my pleasure, and I will apologize for not bringing you on sooner. But there's a story behind that.
Yeah.
So early on when I first started interviewing folks, I was doing them in person at the HQ. And actually, you were never around when I did them. I don't know why. So I didn't get you invited then. And then when we went to this whole pandemic thing and I was doing everything remote, I had to start sending things through Aaron, to make sure that they were okay, to make sure it's okay if I interview different people and stuff. And generally, he was fine with me just kind of asking people and doing stuff. But then I got a little bit I had a little difficulty getting a hold of some folks. So I just said, you know what, I'm just going to do freelancers and things. And because you're kind of in this weird middle space as a member of the network and a developer and a freelancer, I just kind of put you in the group of developers that I'm not going to ask right now until I get around to that again. That's all.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about that too, because I had heard that you were doing interviews in person originally, and I thought, oh, that sounds fun, but I'm just going to wait till this whole thing blows over, and then I'll be there at the office, and it'll be more fun to do it in person.
Oh,
here we are, a year and a half later, and you mentioned that you're looking for people to interview.
Yeah.
I figured, you know what, it's been long enough. I'm just going to do it. If we want to do another in-person one, maybe some other time, we could definitely do that. I'd be up for that still. But there's no sense in holding this off for the sake of like, oh, well, maybe we can do it in person in six months.
Well, you guys are in the office, so I guess it's not bad. I'm especially careful. I prefer to do it all online right now. So
yeah. No, and I don't even know if we could have any guests in the office.
Yeah.
I think only a handful of us, about a dozen of us, are actually in the office yet. I'm still at home, so it wouldn't work out. So this is fine, and I've grown accustomed to doing the online chats by this
Excellent.
Point.
Well, Luis is a developer at Paizo, working on the Pathfinder Lost Omens line, and formerly on campaign settings and player companion lines. He's done freelance work for Paizo, Legendary Games, Rogue Genius Games, and other third-party publishers. In addition, Luis is a longtime contributor to the No Direction Network, including GMing the Valiant Actual Play Pathfinder 2nd Edition podcast, co-hosting the Legend Lore Pathfinder 2nd Edition podcast, and writing the Monstrous Physique blog. If you want more information on all the cool stuff that Luis is doing, you can check out luisloza.com.
That sounds like so much. Now that you put it all on the list, I realize how much work this all really is.
I was shocked. I don't know a lot about you. And so I kind of do a little research, and it's like, wow, you're a busy guy.
Yes. I don't think I'd be as busy if I weren't working from home. Being able to save the time where I don't go between the office and stuff, or I can just immediately switch gears to something else, makes it a lot easier. So maybe that'll change in the future.
Oh, I know. We're so spoiled by that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my normal commute's like an hour each way. And so not doing that, it's like, yeah, it's going to be rough when I go back. So can you tell me about your journey to becoming a Pathfinder developer? How did you get that highly coveted position?
Oh, how far back do you want to go? Because I feel like in a way you could kind of trace this back all the way to how did you get started with RPGs?
Well, I mean, whatever you think is relevant, people do it all the way back that far. Other people start it actually not as far back as I think they should. And if you do that, I'll ask you more questions. So whatever you like.
Well, I guess I'll just say my first big foray into RPGs started in high school. I was playing 3rd edition D&D, playing 3.5. Eventually, all of my friends that I was playing with, they all moved away because they were a year above me in school. So I was left all alone. But then college rolled around, and that's right around when 4th edition was coming out. We got very excited. I had met up with some of these friends again. Got very excited, got into 4E. And one of the things that we ended up doing is homebrewing a lot just because that's how we were doing it in high school. We didn't know that there were published adventures. And that's where I really got the itch for GMing and for telling stories, and kind of realized that I have this love for gaming. I've grown up playing video games a lot, and games are just super fun. I also like telling stories. I like writing. And this is kind of a nice marriage of both. It is mm-hmm. games. It is storytelling at the same time. So a thing I became really interested in, so I kind of fell into the position of the GM, the forever GM, as they call it. A few years later, I'm just sitting around browsing the internet, and I see this picture, this image macro, this meme, that has the cover artwork from the second volume of Rise of the Rune Lords, mm-hmm. which is the Skinsaw Murders. It has a picture of, you know, spooky haunted house in the background, and it has a well in the foreground with a bunch of ghouls coming out, one of them carrying a body that's like wrapped up in a blanket or something. It looks really scary. It looks really freaky. And the caption was just, "Foxglove Manor, the scariest night you'll ever have in D&D. And I was immediately intrigued. I wanted to know what this was. I looked it up and looked up Foxglove Manor and learned about Pathfinder. Hey, there's this adventure path thing. They're writing these adventures. I tracked down the very first adventure, Burnt Offerings, and was immediately blown away. I had seen some pre-written adventures a little bit before. There was like one or two I saw during the 4E days. This is the first time I had like actually just like fell into it and started reading it and wanted to just read more and more and find out about this world and about the story that's going on. I got super excited and wanted to run it for people. Soon enough, we're playing Pathfinder because the core rulebook had just come out, basically, our first AP. I decided to run that. And eventually, after getting, you know, becoming a full-on Paizo fanboy, going onto the message boards and everything, and taking a stab at homebrewing some stuff here and there, I decided I'm going to try to, like, write for real. Let's find something to write for. And there were a few different things. If you would frequent the boards back in the early days of first edition Pathfinder, the third party section of the boards was very, very active. And there were a lot of calls for people to write things or contests and things like that. And that's when I found a contest that was being run by Adventure Week Games, who's still going strong. They're doing a lot of 5e adventures and stuff right now. But they were asking for pitches on adventures, five best pitches. Would get paid to write that adventure. And then from then on, the people, or those adventures would be released. People would get the chance to read through each of these adventures, and whichever adventure got the most votes would then become the winner of this contest and get to write their own adventure path. I pitched for it. I got in the top five. And one of the other people that got in there was Jacob W. Michaels.
Okay.
Yeah. He does a lot of freelancing for Paizo as well, but I think he and I kind of got started around the same time, and we both made it into this top five. I got paid $100 for this adventure, which is, I think, more than most people get on their very first RPG yeah. freelance product. And I didn't win this contest, unfortunately, but I had a product and I had something written in my name. And from there, my editor who read through my adventure actually reached out to me personally and said, "Hey, I really like your stuff. Would you be willing to write with me for some other third party stuff?" I ended up jumping in on that opportunity. I wrote some third party stuff for Rogue Genius and Legendary through my contact, Mike Myler, who's done a lot of work and continues to do a lot of work right now through the N-World magazine, Insider, I think, which is 5e based. But he got me kind of like my first opportunity to do my own thing. He had his own homebrew campaign setting that he was going to get published, which is called the Varanthia Codex. He gave me essentially a continent to write all on my own, trusted me enough to do that. And I did it and ended up doing a lot more work with him. And with that in hand, I was able to turn to Paizo, who I, you know, wanted to write for at this point, and say, "Hey, here's my samples. Let's do something." I reached out to Wes Schneider, who was editor in chief. I don't remember if he was editor in chief at the time, but eventually he was editor in chief during his last couple of years at Paizo. Reached out to him. He gave me the opportunity to write for my first player companion, which was the Giant Hunter's Handbook. I guess I did well enough that I impressed Patrick Reaney, and he who I think then handed off the line to Owen Casey Stevens when Patrick left for a while. Owen got back to me, and I ended up doing a lot of player companion work, eventually some campaign setting work, and learned the ropes, learned the ins and outs of Paizo freelancing, kind of did, I think, as best as I could at the time. There's always obviously stuff I look back at now. It's like, actually you should have formatted that better, or you could have tweaked the language, but you know, I got a lot of experience. And when the time came around 2017, there was the opening for a developer that came up on the site. I was wary about doing it. I was kind of wishy-washy. My wife had just moved to grad school, so we packed up all our things and had moved to Bloomington, Indiana about 2 months prior, and we were set to live there for 2 years while she's going through grad school. And suddenly here's this opportunity for dream job that comes up. She is very supportive and also points out the fact that because she's in grad school, she doesn't really have time to pay attention to me.
Oh man, go do your own thing. Fine. Yeah. Fine.
It's okay if you go do your own thing for a while. So I apply, and after I apply, I get to go to the next round, which involves a development test. Mm-hmm. They send me some copy. They give me a turnover that's effectively very bad. Ask me to fix it up and clean it up as if I were working there. Things like that. And ended up getting the job. So I moved to Seattle later that year. We ended up having Christmas together, and then off I went to Washington and started in 2018, and I've been here ever since. I think I was just kind of a part of a big hiring wave in what is now in reflection, obviously in anticipation of Pathfinder Second Edition. We're here to hold the fort until we can transition over, and there were other people already doing that work, so we're kind of here to cover what's left of 1E while things switch over. So was it. Doing a lot of third-party work, and then eventually pitching to Paizo.
So that's when Ron came on as well, that same December then, right?
Yeah, Ron was in December. I started in January, so we're a few weeks separated. Eleanor Farron, who is my counterpart on the Lost Omens line, started 2 weeks after I did. James Case and Leo Glass, a lot of editors, started around then too. So there was just a big push. I think 6 or 7 different people hired and started within the same span of about 2 months.
Wow. Very cool. So can you tell us what you do as a developer, what this thing entails? You kind of alluded to fixing up or turnover, in the developer test, which we've heard about in previous interviews. But what does it mean to be a developer?
So a developer is effectively the director of a product. They're the ones that have the ultimate vision of what this product should be. Whether or not that was their vision initially, right? Sometimes there are developers that come onto a product that has already been started just based on how things work. But usually what it means is I and Eleanor working together will come up with an idea for a product. Let's say Gods and Magic, a book all about gods and adding new gods and expanding on domains, new spells, things like that. And we then kind of pitch that idea to the rest of the teams, to the higher ups. If we kind of have the okay for that, we gather we circle the wagons, get as many people to throw out ideas at what could be in this book. We ask for which gods are your favorites. What domains do we think aren't covered? What kind of new spells would be fun? What kind of new weapons? What kind of new magic items? So on and so forth. And from there, we take all of that information, we prune it down to what we think we like best for the product, and write an outline. From there, the outline goes out to our freelancers, our freelance authors. We say, here's this book. Do you want to write for it? We get everyone on board. And then during that writing process, about halfway through, they send us in what's called their milestones. And we kind of review it to do course corrections or offer advice or answer any questions they might have. Eventually, the final text comes in. We do an editing pass. We make sure to line up as much as we can with continuity and existing canon. We clean up any rules language, anything like that. We basically do this just heavy, heavy pass of every potential thing that's in there. And additionally, we also order the art that comes in the books. We request specific pieces. Like, hey, I need a piece that looks like a worshiper of Phirasma, and she's wearing this type of clothing and is holding a dagger in her hand. Things like that. Based on the existing text that we have there, it's sent off to our editing team, who then does a much better job at editing than I ever will, I'm sure. it's handed over to our art team, who puts it on the page itself, and it comes back to us like that on the page. Unfortunately, how things work is nothing ever fits properly on the page, so we typically have to go in and cut lines to make sure it all fits, or we have to add text to make sure it fits the entire page. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And after that, it goes to editing one last time. It comes back to us for our last checkup, and there it goes. So we kind of guide the book the entire way, keeping the vision that we have for that. But as a developer, because we're working on so many books, we have usually 3 to 4 books. We're doing that same process on all 4 books, but each of these books are in a different stage along the way. So, you know, right now I'm finishing up an outline. I have just finished up development text that I sent off to our editing team. And before that, a couple weeks before that, we had finished up the Monsters of Myth Lost Omens book and did our final approvals pass to make sure that we did that last checkup to make sure everything was okay before sending it off. So that was all within the span of about 3 or 4 weeks. And I'm about to move on to the next steps on other things too. So it's just constantly moving between all these steps and keeping up with several books at once.
So you mentioned this outline and you just kind of glossed over that pretty quickly. I've seen some of these for books. They're pretty lengthy.
Oh yeah.
That's a pretty detailed outline. And you mentioned, you know, you figure out what goes in there, but it's more than just what goes in, right?
Yeah, it's more than just saying, it would be easy to have an outline and say, all right, I need you to provide 4 pages worth of new feats or new spells or something. But it's one thing to do that. It's another thing to do, what I try to do at least, is then ask for specifics, ask for... I provide qualifications on what we need and provide some suggestions. So rather than just say, hey, give me new spells, I might say, you know, we did the Pathfinder Society book, so I might want spells that are good for exploration and getting around in dungeons. So I might say, all right, give me 4 pages of spells that are exploration themed, which is already more guidance than some cases where I've seen in past outlines in Paizo's history. But from then on, I would also offer suggestions. You know, I'd say in the outline itself, some of these might be things that make it easier to move through narrow corridors so you can squeeze around better. Some of these spells might be good at detecting the presence of traps. And some of these spells might be good at helping guide you so you don't get lost underground or something. You know, just some suggestions. I don't necessarily ever expect people to use those exact suggestions. If they do, that's great. You know, that's the kind of thing I'm looking for. But I think I try to inspire, try to get the wheels turning for our authors on what we want. And then in some cases, we do have to ask for very specific things based on what we need.
Right.
So in the case of, let's say, the Lost Omens character guide, we knew we had an existing Hell Knight archetype in the world guide that we wanted to kind of serve as a stepping stone into a proper Hell Knight. So when we ordered this this archetype in Lost Omens character guide, the proper Hell Knight archetype, not the Armiger, which is the kind of apprentice fledgling to be Hell Knight, we specifically asked that it has information, has rules that call out that you can use the existing archetype to build into this one seamlessly. So asking for specifics like that is very important. Sometimes the Grand Bazaar book that's coming out, we specifically asked, hey, we need this many staves, this many potions, this many wands and stuff like that. So we had a nice mix of different items, because if I just said, hey, make some new magic items, I might end up with 80% new weapons and armor. And anyone who's looking for new potions and alchemical items will feel like, well, where's all the stuff I wanted? So in some cases, we do have to get very specific on that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that you'll give authors some suggestions. And this is a question I have as an author, because I'll see Yeah, I want you to develop some new character things here. And for example, you could do this, this, and this. Or an adventure, you could have these sorts of skill challenges and stuff. And so you don't expect people to have to do that. But if they do that, you're happy, you said.
Yeah, I would not give any suggestion that I would not actually want to print on the page.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. I'm thinking if a developer says these are things that would be good in here, it seems like you should do those things, right?
It won't hurt, I think. Okay. At the very least, those are there as fallbacks, nice kind of safety net for you. If you get 80% of the way done, and you're like, I can't think of two more feats. Luckily, there's these two examples I can use, so I'll work with that.
Okay. All right. So the expectation isn't that, oh, yeah, these ones, I told you about these ones as examples, but I don't want you to use them. So it's not like that then, right?
No, I want people to use the examples if it helps. And I know that I never give enough examples to cover the entirety of the section anyway. So you can't rely on just my notes the entire way through.
Oh, yeah. No, for sure. Now, I was just wondering because I'm working on something now and it's actually I'm given some very specific things and I think, okay, I can do those and maybe I'll make some more creative things than this or something like that. So,
yeah, I think we try our best to specifically let you know when we absolutely must have a thing.
Right.
And if we haven't told you that, you're kind of free to work within the color within the lines as needed.
Okay, cool. So, you've done, as far as I can tell, up until recently, almost exclusively Pathfinder work. And then this thing came out that I ran on 4th of July called Band on the Run, a Starfinder one-shot.
Yeah.
Was that your first Starfinder project?
No, I've done some Starfinder work before. I don't jump into Starfinder products as often as I do Pathfinder products, partially because I just don't know the system as well, but also because I am more interested in keeping up to date on my Pathfinder rules and everything. And also, I communicate more with the Pathfinder side of the team more often. So I'm more aware of stuff that's coming down the pipeline anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just wondering, because it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to run for that. My players really enjoyed it. And so I just want to commend you on doing such a great job.
Well, thank you very much. I hope you had fun finding all the little Easter eggs among like the encounter titles and stuff.
Those weren't Easter eggs. Those are like blaring in your faces. Come on.
Yes. Absolutely. But some of them are like obscure references, more obscure to music, I think. So I'm like calling out punk rock. And if you don't know punk rock, but your typical classical rock, like the Rolling Stones references probably are just fine, but something like Suspect Device might fly over your head if you don't know that.
Yeah, we had somebody who was a very, very very knowledgeable music aficionado was pointing out a lot of stuff for us. So
that's great.
So that was good. But it was a lot of fun. One thing I will ask is how is it writing outside of your kind of your area of expertise like that?
So in particular, Band on the Run was really fun to write because Starfinder, the Starfinder writing, Starfinder voice is more casual. So it was a lot easier to write in a way that I think I'm better suited for. Not that I don't feel like I can't write, for Pathfinder. I've obviously been doing it for years now. But it's Pathfinder is very fantasy, kind of prosy, purple prosy writing here and there. There's a definite idea for what your fantasy RPG writing should sound like. That's been established and we're kind of keeping up that tradition. But Starfinder is more modern. It uses a lot of more modern language and it means I can have more fun with writing it. I can write a little sillier, a little more loose. And to me, if you've read the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, that kind of goofy language where you kind of have asides and stuff that point out things is something that comes more naturally to me. So I got to write that kind of thing. It wasn't obviously exactly a comedy adventure, but I got to have a little bit more fun on describing things and how I expressed what was going on. Like the diner at the very beginning describes, you know, all the patrons that they just kind of let out grumbles whenever anything happens. And, you know, that kind of thing, I don't think would normally be something we put into a Pathfinder product. But for Starfinder, it's a lot more fun. I can get away with a lot of that. And also I can use terms like web and phones and stuff like that to explain some stuff.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned this kind of looser language. I'm kind of curious because I like a lot of pop culture references and things. And, you know, we do that when we're gaming and things. And I tried to work in something into a product, something I wrote for an upcoming product that is really, really silly, but I tried to really disguise it and word it well. And what do the developers think about that when you try to make a very clever reference in there, you know, like an Easter egg to put in there?
Oh boy. So our internal request, internally, we kind of state no Easter eggs, right? The only kind of Easter egg should be pointing back at other Pathfinder products. So if you name drop some NPC or some location from existing Pathfinder canon, that's the kind of Easter eggs we want. We want to reward people who are paying attention or know all of our lore. We don't want you to put in a law enforcer who is known as a judge, right? And is kind of a dreadful guy. We wouldn't want that kind of thing. But Band on the Run was particularly interesting because I was given this outline, and Jason Keeley, my developer for that, I asked him, are we really going with this name, knowing it's a reference to, you know, to Wings, Parmigiani Wings. And he said, our publisher, Eric Mona, approved it. Everyone approved it. I asked that same question. They said it was fine. And with that, I felt like that's our blessing to, well, this time we get to kind of lean into it and have fun with it and do these kind of things. For the most part, if you do Easter eggs, we ask as developers that you leave a comment or point it out in some way, so we are aware of it. And then we kind of leave it to our best judgment on that. Something that is blatant, like a Judge Dredd ripoff guy, would probably get cut right away. But something,
For sure.
Something sometimes I see people name drop like the name of their adventuring party as a rival mercenary group or something. You know, that's a personal Easter egg that you can kind of point to your friends, and that's fine, and that's not going to run into any problems unless your mercenary group was called the Fellowship of the Ring or something, right? But for the most part, things like that or things that are particularly veiled and we feel that won't get us into any legal trouble or anything end up kind of getting by here and there. But it really is on a case-by-case basis. It varies from dev to dev. It seems like the rule is, if I get the reference or I like that reference, then it seems to survive, which is kind of not necessarily the best way to do it. But for the most part, as long as you have it pointed out, we do our best to make it survive or at least make it work if it feels like it's not going to get us into trouble or if it's not jarring to read something like that.
Right. Oh, for sure. For sure. Interesting. Okay. Well, I will actually talk to you about that when we're done recording, because I'm curious what your take is on something in particular, because I have no idea if it's going to survive. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that it does. Yeah. All right. So what kind of advice do you have for people that are interested in breaking into freelance RPG writing, you know, with third-party publishers, but also especially with Paizo?
So the first thing I tell everyone is to just write and put it somewhere. It doesn't matter if it's officially published or not. Having some kind of examples of your writing is more important than anything else. So when I started, I ended up making a blog. I didn't need to get too many samples, personal samples on my own, because I was able to get so much work pretty quickly that I can then turn around and point to people. But I've seen this. I've given this advice. I've seen it work. I've given it to people and seen it work personally. So it's not just a thing that used to work and now doesn't. No, it still works. I've seen it happen. People could just find a free blog site, you know, something like Blogger would be fine, or WordPress or something, and throw up what you're writing on there. It doesn't have to be particularly long or fancy. You know, we don't need you to write an entire adventure to know that you are good at writing encounters. You can write just a single encounter. Hey, I took these monsters from the bestiary and I wrote an encounter for them, and just describe the map, or I drew a map, or I gave you a new magic item, new feats, whatever it is. But having some examples of your writing, both mechanical, both technical writing and prose, your fiction writing, or if it's narrative material or setting material, is going to help out a lot. And then from there, depending on what game you want to write for, if it's Pathfinder 2E, if it's Starfinder, if it's D&D 5E, whatever the game you want, make sure you're writing for that game. It's very easy to be like, I know 5E, so I'm just going to write a bunch of 5E magic items, and then I'm going to use that as my sample for anything. But when you come to me with 5E samples, that doesn't tell me how good you are with your Pathfinder. Yeah, I don't know your Pathfinder skills based on this. I might be able to tell your prose is good, and personally, I can see, you know, how good you are with 5E. That doesn't help me on my day job in terms of finding new authors. But if you're going to write for 5E, make sure you write like stuff is published in 5E. If you want to write for Pathfinder, make sure it matches what it's like in the Pathfinder books that you're reading. Try to find where things are bolded, where things are italicized, things like that. Try to match the format of what you're seeing on the page as much as possible. It's going to be impossible to do it 100% of the way, regardless of how you do it, until you get our internal styles that we use for stuff. But if you can try to make it match as much as possible on your blog, or if you, you know, put together a little PDF that you send someone of your homebrew writing, and it matches as best as possible, it'll show that you're paying attention to the details beyond just the mechanics and the writing. You're paying attention to the formatting, you're paying attention to the styling, which is important to know, because if you're not formatting your stat blocks correctly, you could end up with errors. You could end up making stat blocks that are just outright incorrect. So having that kind of thing in mind is really a good thing to be doing. And then from there, once you have some samples, reach out to people. There are plenty of third-party companies. Rogue Genius Games is one. Everybody Games is another one. Legendary Games. People that you can reach out, that you can offer samples. You can and show, here's some work I've done. Even if it isn't published, that might be enough to get your foot in the door. Well, to say, oh, well, actually, I have this thing that I need. 500 words on new potions. Do you want to cover that? And that might be your first step on doing so. And from there, you can get a few credits under your name, and then work with that to reach out to someone at Paizo and say, I have these third party credits here. You know, I've officially been published doing Pathfinder stuff. You should be usually able to speak with your publisher and ask for the permission to send the samples to us so we can also read them. Or if not, you can have them, you can tell us to reach out to, you know, Jason at Legendary or Owen at Rogue Genius or whatever. And we can ask, hey, how's this person doing? How was their work? And based on that, we might be able to give you something. It might be small to start off with. It might be a quest for Pathfinder Society, or it might be just two pages in a Lost Omens book or something. But having your samples to start with is the important thing that shows that you're capable of the work, and then use that to build up from there.
So speaking of contacting folks at Paizo, so say you're a freelancer and you've gotten some work, for you, how often do you like your freelancers to let you know they're available for additional projects?
I usually tell people once every month or every 2 months to reach out. Okay. The thing is with Lost Omens books, because there's usually only about four in a year, we will assign the book and then not have anything to assign for 3 months.
Right.
But what we do have here is an internal means of communicating with all the rest of the developers and designers and say, hey, John reached out to me. I don't have anything to offer, but I know he did some good work with monsters and we're doing this monster book. I'll reach out to the design team and say, hey, John might be someone you want to contact about this. Or something like that. And, you know, you might get work out of that, not through the person you meant to ask, but, you know, that can happen. I've seen it happen a lot of times, especially if there's no way to know from an outside perspective when the right time to strike is. But if you happen to get in just as like an outline is finishing up, or just as a designer or developer is about to assign something, you might get in right away, or you might be waiting a couple months, and it's okay. You might not get anything back. I want to tell people to make it very clear that just because you don't hear back from us, it doesn't mean we hate you, or it doesn't mean we don't want to give you any work. If we don't want to work with you, we will let you know.
But that's good to know. You just won't ghost people then.
Yeah, we there's a lot of times where like something comes in and we just don't have time to respond. But if no response doesn't mean you failed with us. It's when you hear from us that we tell you failed with us. That's when things are bad. So not hearing from us, it doesn't necessarily mean you're out of the opportunity to work. Just check back in another month or two, and just wait to see what happens. Unfortunately, I think nowadays more than ever, we have more freelancers than we have words to assign. Unfortunately, we just can't get a project for everyone like we could back in the older days when I was still doing player companions. It was very easy to throw pages at, 2 to 4 pages at someone for a little bit every month. But now that I have to wait every 3 months to do something, it takes a lot longer before I can get some work for someone.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to note. Jason Tondro actually just posted about this today on his Facebook, telling people that I only have so many projects to assign, and there's lots of people we'd like to get them out to. So, sorry, it's not like you're not good enough. We just don't have enough, So.
Yeah, but ideally, if you have worked for Paizo a couple of times, 2 or 3 times, you can use that to kind of pivot towards other games or other companies as well. Your technical skill in terms of technical writing can be used in other games. You might not know the rule set right away, but ideally, if you've written for Paizo, you're one of the top writers out there and are able to pick up new rules. You could switch over to 5e D&D, or you could switch over to Call of Cthulhu or something, because you know how to follow formatting and styling and all those basics that are kind of needed, and then just focus on learning those new rules as you need for a project. So if you've written for us and you haven't heard from us, don't be afraid to try out other games.
Yeah, no, I think that's great advice. So last question, what kind of cool things are you working on that you can actually talk about?
Oh boy. That I can see, that's that qualifier there, what I can actually talk about.
I know. Well, you can talk about stuff in general, but I know that they're really particular about doing anything like that. So
I'm not working on it anymore, but I have an Adventure Path volume that's coming out in a few months for the Strength of Thousands Adventure Path one, that's kind of based out of the Mwangi Expanse and connected to the Mangambi Academy. I'm doing the 4th volume, which is the Secrets of the Temple City. And I feel like, even though it was a lot of work, it ended up being one of my, if not my best adventures I've ever written, just in terms of everything you can do and the interesting things you can do in that adventure. It's very, very diplomacy, very, very intrigue focused for a long time in that adventure, to the point where basically the first third of the adventure is just all social stuff, which, let me tell you, is very difficult to do when there's like no examples of how to do something for that long of a duration. It's easy enough to do like a social encounter or two, but when it has to be an entire level's worth of content, that's a lot.
Yeah.
But I think I managed to pull it off, and Ron has told me it was a good job. So I'm hopeful. I'm excited for people to see that.
Yeah. So no monsters in it?
There are monsters, but for the first third or so of the adventure, it's basically, there's basically like one encounter that happens early on.
Okay.
And then that's it.
And then the last of it is just full of monsters then, right?
Yeah. Then the rest of it is more of your typical adventure stuff. But for the first whole third of it, it's just social and intrigue and stuff, and if you wanted to, as a GM, you could add fights for people who want to have fights, but by the default assumption is you're just going around talking to people.
All right, well, that I'm actually really looking forward to that one. I'm looking forward to
playing that. You have monsters in that.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what makes it, you know?
No, I believe so. You do. I can see the adventures in advance. I know a few people at Paizo, so they let me see they let me see those. And I believe Ron mentioned that your monsters are in there along with mine.
Oh, excellent. Good, good. Well, I look forward to seeing the final form on all that. So Well, Luis, this has been actually a lot of fun. We should have done this a long time ago. So thanks again for joining us on the podcast.
No problem. I'm happy to chat about this anytime.